This episode is brought to you by Home Team Inspection Service. When you partner with Home Team, you're getting more than a home inspection. You're delivering the home team experience. With a team approach, fast turnarounds, and package options that include home inspection warranties, Home Team helps real estate pros stand out. Plus, many locations now offer pay at close, giving your clients flexibility when they need it most. Schedule your next inspection with confidence at hometeam.com.
Working on Wall Street with a nice big paycheck was exciting, but when you're making six figures on Wall Street and then you're bringing in 10, 11, 12,000 a month in rental income, money that you're earning while you're asleep, I've been addicted to it ever since. I mean, it changed my whole perspective.
Welcome to the Color Money Podcast. This is Bo Minchiti, and I am joined by my amazing co-host, the dynamic Daniel Dixon. We have a special treat for you today. We have two amazing gentlemen, and although there are elements of their stories that seem to have followed each other through some of their paths, they also bring some very unique experiences to the table. I've had the pleasure of knowing Vernon and Eric over the past couple of years. Vernon's the CEO and Eric is the COO of Diversified Lending Solutions, a company that they've created that really helps to identify bespoke solutions for folks in the real estate and investment space around debt and equity. And we'll let them tell you a little bit more about that. They are both graduates of Columbia University. Vernon holds an MBA from Harvard Business School. Eric got a venture management certificate from Harvard Business School. So they did some educational paths and gone. They both worked at Goldman Sachs, I think, at different times and in different places. But they have a number of experiences that across a number of, you know, large organizations and small organizations. But most importantly, they are folks that have been uniquely dedicated to this idea of building wealth for diverse communities. And so we're really excited to have them here. Thanks for joining us, Vernon and Eric.
Bo, thanks for being here. I have to say, I'm a big fan of the podcast. Big shout out to your community because it's great what you guys created. So just happy to be a part of it.
Well, it is great to have you guys. Maybe just to get started, maybe just if you gave us just a little bit about short overview of the backgrounds and then how you guys came together.
Sure. And I'll try not to bore the audience too much with our background. But short story is Eric and I both started on Wall Street together. In structured finance, cut our teeth in banking at a time when, you know, the hottest jobs weren't tech jobs, it was finance jobs. And we all wanted to be Gordon Gekko when we grew up. And both realized very early on that real estate was a really exciting asset class. And frankly, there weren't a ton of folks that looked like us, but there were a few, and there were some pretty big bankers. And that really provided a huge motivation for getting in finance. And then we grew very quickly in the investment sphere. Started doing small deals on our own, either, you know, for ourselves or with others. And Eric has some amazing stories about that. And that effectively grew into what is now the Diversified Companies, which is a capital markets advisor for small, diverse, and emerging real estate developers. And we can get into what that means, but effectively, we want to expand access to capital to help turbocharge the growth of those type of enterprises. So we kind of saw how big companies could get with capital on Wall Street, and we wanted to emulate that for communities that frankly just haven't traditionally had it.
Put it really simply, they help people access the money they need, do the deals that they got to do. And they do that across all the different pieces of the money stack, which we'll talk about a little bit more. But Eric, yeah.
I can't disagree with a lot that Vernon said, but what I will say is that he mentioned we all wanted to be like Gordon Gekko. That's true up to a point. What I will also add, though, is, you know, we went to Columbia together. When we started at Columbia, it was the last year of the dollar brownstones in Harlem. And I would say, you know, my path to getting here started there because by the time we graduated college, I had closed on a few deals as a college senior. And working at Goldman Sachs, working on Wall Street with a nice big paycheck was exciting. But when you're making six figures on Wall Street and then you're bringing in 10, 11, 12,000 a month in rental income, money that you're earning while you're asleep, I've been addicted to it ever since. I mean, it changed my whole perspective. You know, you spend 4 years learning to grow to be this Wall Street executive, and then you realize I make as much money when my head's on my pillow because of some astute decisions I made while at school you can't look back. And so I haven't held one job since then, because as I've been building my career, I've also been doing real estate entrepreneurship full time. It's work, but it's also the hobby, the passion, and the lifestyle.
I got to quickly say, because, like, you know, Eric was that guy in college who was like gobbling, who took Monopoly literally. He's like, all right, I'm really going to do this. And like when guys were at a party or hanging out and like, where is Eric? It's like, I'm cleaning the toilet. And I'm like, what am I doing? And then I got to go to Goldman on Monday and like do an asset management report. We're like, this guy's a lunatic. So it's looking back where you get the perspective, where you appreciate his vision. At the time, I think we all thought he was a little, you know,
cuckoo. A little off. Speaking of that, like, how did you two come together and when did you decide to actually go into business together?
Yeah, I mean, we've been joining forces since we were on so on campus. There was one person of color besides myself who was always on student council. And I mean, I ran every year. We were both on student government. But every time I looked to my left, Vernon was the guy also on student government. And so you start learning to the importance of collaboration early, and you start to see the synergies in kind of smart, talented, industrious folks. And so the intrigue started there, but what started as collaborating on campus initially became collaborating by being active checks, kind of co-investing into deals together. And then after the great financial crisis, when we saw an opportunity to, you know, there were a lot happening in the financial sector. We were at the front door of that. We launched an advisory firm first. They're helping to assess, do loss forecasting on failed institutions and assets. And so grew that business. And so what you learn is that when you have a partner, you know, we like to use the word, what's your unique superpower? When you have someone else that you can leverage, you know, in real estate, you have leverage, but in team building, when you have someone with unique skill sets that you can leverage, it, you know, it lifts the collective. And so, you know, our strengths are complementary, but our alignment, our vision of the world tends to be fairly similar. And so active checks, co-investing, we see the world through a lot of the same lenses, and both of us have a sincere desire to kind of lift as we climb. And so we build businesses that encircle those mission points.
How'd you go from investing together to the diversified lending solution? Like, when did diversified lending solutions come into play?
Yeah, so it's twofold. So the first thing was that as we were on the street together, we were both looking at deals at 10, 11, 12 o'clock together. No one was awake except us and the attorneys. Mm-hmm. The common gripe we always had was, man, there's never any brothers or sisters or women that get credit committee approvals. Kind of, no one that looks like us ever gets the rubber stamp into the last credit room. And so we've been collecting notes on how to get there and successfully navigate the deal side since we were kind of on the approval side. The second thing that happened was, you know, what initially was, you know, in acting as investors, you start having some liquidity events. And then you have a liquidity events that also streamline into successful exits. And so you have more money. And so we're earning more and also having exits in our deals. And so what became, you know, when your knowledge meets your capital, it creates a whole unique basket of opportunities. And so that's what DCI became. It became, wow, we were looking at ourselves as financial sector veterans with a nice pot of cash, a good amount of cash, and also skill set relationships, behind the scenes kind of trade secrets that were valuable. And so we thought, you know, what better time than now to figure out a way to capitalize on it?
You said something really interesting, like, that just comes up a lot in these conversations, like, when your knowledge meets your capital, and that they're at the right levels to be at the same level. Because I think this conversation comes up a lot of times, especially in our communities, where people are like, well, I'm just missing the capital. And you could have capital and not have the knowledge. You could also, oftentimes, also be folks that have the knowledge who spent times grinding but haven't built the personal capital to deploy that. And we talk about this. We have this wealth building continuum framework we talk about here that talks about trading time and talent for money. And when you trade time and talent and money for money, and when you just trade money for money, and when you're in the time and talent and money for money space in the middle, which is, this is where you multiply your wealth. This is where knowledge meets capital, because you have to be able to deploy capital behind that knowledge to take that risk. And so I don't know how you guys think about that and how you think that has affected, especially communities of color, in both of those ways, where the knowledge doesn't meet the capital or the capital doesn't meet the knowledge.
So you hit the nail on the head, right? So much of our time, if you ask us, what do we spend our time on today? And a lot of our time spent today is working with whole cohorts of developers and providing them the technical assistance and the capacity building they need to bridge that gap. Like you said, for most developers, the complaint or the issue is, I don't have the money. I'm the best guy in the room nobody will throw a check at, right? There's an element of truth to that. But okay, once we get past that, let's actually peel back the layers of the onion. And when we sit with developers, we find that in many cases, there's some pretty glaring holes in terms of their understanding of what a capital provider, whether that's a lender, whether that's private equity, whether that's high net worth, would want to see in order to feel comfortable putting their money in their deal. So if I know my deal's great, but I can't speak to the metrics, I can't speak to an equity multiple, I can't speak to an IRR. When you ask me what my documentation is, it's a bunch of, you know, papers thrown around and some messy Excel spreadsheets. I can't give you the confidence that I am more than a one-trick pony that maybe bird-dogged and found a deal, because everything else after that is less refined. And so the goal for us is that even if you're the smartest guy in the room and get site control and you know how to find deals, let's actually bridge the knowledge gap so that you can project the intelligence you already possess to the folks that are in a position to help you accelerate. And then it becomes a flywheel, because once you get it done a couple times, then you can magnify it.
The other thing I'll add is that what Vernon is speaking to is sometimes there's perception of having the knowledge, but not really having the knowledge. So the training he's referencing is getting folks to an institutional level. But what I'll also say is that capital is also resources, right? And so it's your relationships. And so while we're helping them to bridge the knowledge capital, we're also introducing, building their relationship and their actual kind of their financial capital. And so what does that mean? So when someone can walk into a room and look the part, when they're all the things that Vernon mentioned, when they are institutionally big equity ready, what we'll do is, the first thing we'll do is we'll expand their relationship capital. And so we'll bring them to the friendly millionaire or billionaire that's looking for an opportunity to be a key principal or co-JV or a guarantor. The next thing we'll do is, when they're partnered with an institutional partner that expands their relationship capital, we go out looking for the actual monetary capital. And what you'll find is, when someone looks the part and has a team that is representative of what the institutional space might expect, finding that gap that you mentioned, Bo, finding the actual monetary capital, it becomes a much easier bridge to cross.
So when we think about the thought of finding a deal, mm-hmm. If I'm understanding correctly, these operators are out finding opportunities and they're coming to you guys to help make them essentially bankable. Yes. How can we get the funding that we need to go build the project we have? When you think about finding a deal, a lot of our listeners don't have the capital, but they're boots on the street in every market across the country. And unfortunately, a lot of times we're not looking at this from the mindset of, how do I find the deal for myself? We're out shopping for investors. So what's one or two things that some of these people that are getting started in this can look and see? What do we look at for a deal? What are we looking for?
So one of the things that I think is really critical for an early investor, early developer, is understand where you add value, right? So like you said, developer or investor may say, I don't have capital, so I got to start small, right? I got to live in my little wheelhouse and get a little bigger. Maybe when I look up 20 years from now, I'll be really big. That's not really how we view it. We view it in terms of, even if you're small, there's some huge value that you can add. If you understand this 5-block radius really well, and presumably you know what a good deal is, focus all your efforts on getting site control over a deal. Just get site control.
What do you mean by site control? Yeah.
It means whether it's through a letter of intent or some agreement, it's something that locks in your ability to obtain ownership over that asset at some future point in time. Doesn't mean you bought it today. but it means that you have somehow worked your way into a deal in a way that's more advantageous than every Tom, Dick, and Harry on the street.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have a deal and you have access to a property at a price, you're instantly valuable if you've set the right price.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a $100,000 deal or $1 million deal or $2 million deal, if I have the right to buy something that's worth $1 million for $950,000, I've created value for someone. So the first thing I would say is figure out how you can add value. And once you figure out how you add that, then you can figure out how to extract it or sell it or share it with someone else.
I love that. You've got to figure out how to create value. So there's too many people coming in asking, how can I extract value? Who haven't actually have a real understanding of how they create value. And to me, one of the biggest things, especially for, I think, a lot of our listeners who have actually real depth of real estate experience, but maybe are trying to go up a notch or take on something that's a little bit different, being really real with yourself about what is the value I bring into this situation and where do I need others. And what is the value of that? Like, if I come and I try to extract all the value for just identifying the site, I'm going to look really funny to everyone else who's got to do the other part. If I undervalue that, though, I could also end up not getting it. So having a real appropriate estimation of the different pieces that make up value before we even mm-hmm. have a conversation about what a partnership or, and that's the foundation, I think, for strong partnerships. Like Eric said earlier, it's about superpowers, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you know your superpower, you know your partner's superpowers, then you're in a great place. That's the foundation for building a partnership. And most of real estate deals and development and all this is just a bunch of partnerships.
Daniel, the other thing I would add is you mentioned that, you know, a lot of your, you know, the listeners are kind of newer investors. I would say they should pay attention to the things that allow them to benefit from OPM, right? And so mm-hmm. the low-hanging fruit. Vernon mentioned site control, but long before I had money, I was getting site control on LOIs, PSAs, and flipping contracts to the local investors. OPM.
Right.
Long before I had money, I was benefiting from seller concessions layered on top of FHA loans and buying quadplexes so that, you know, you're living in one unit rent-free because the first two units are paying for your life, the third is paying for variable costs, and now you set yourself up for a path to financial freedom where...
Yeah.
You can have multiple jobs or no job because home is taken care of. And so there are things people can do even with no money that, you know, if executed well, give you a whole new foundation and launch pad for wealth accumulation.
When people have got a project and they're coming to you and you're thinking about how you position them to the capital markets, what are the things you look for in that? So Daniel asked you about what do you look for in a deal? What do you look for in the sponsor, you know, or the person who's sort of leading the deal? What kind of characteristics are you guys looking for when you're thinking like, hey, I want someone who I can take out and I can help them access what's out there? What do you look for in that individual or in that situation?
Excellent question. So I could give, you know, many examples of developers we've worked with that superficially look very different in how they behave, right? Some are flashier. Some are a little bit more polished. Some are extremely thoughtful. Some seem a little bit more free-flowing. But ultimately, what dictates whether we want to work with them and whether they are passing the smell test are, A, do we think that they have good credibility? They have a history of doing what they said they could do, right? Do they show integrity? And people say that all the time, and then people roll their eyes, but... Even more so, just because I want you to be someone who's integrity or shows integrity, I want to make sure you're not going to burn me, burn my partners, or burn anyone I recommend. There have been times where I would much prefer someone come to me who needs help putting together a deal saying, hey, I got some warts. I got some issues. Can you help me think through it?
Uh-huh.
I'm not here to judge. Eric's not here to judge. We've had many people come with deals that were hairy or had passed that maybe they needed to address some things. Then we can think about how we can work around it if it's not just a non-starter issue. What we don't like is when someone, A, says they can do something, but has shown no connectivity between what they say they're going to do and they've done in the past. And then on top of that, they leave us with the impression that integrity would quickly get compromised if and when something didn't go the way we wanted it to. Eric and I put money on the street. We probably put north of $2 million of our own capital and friends and family capital directly in this cohort of folks that are starting and trying to grow. It's really, really important when you're doing that you're dealing with people that when things don't go the way that you thought they would, which happens a lot in real estate, they're not going to stop picking up the phone. They're not going to start dodging you at every chance they get. They're going to work through the problem with you through transparency, candor, and honesty.
Home Team Inspection Service is changing the way agents and clients experience home inspections. Their team-based model, streamlined scheduling, and bundled packages, including home inspection warranties, make the process smoother from contract to closing. And with Pay at Close available in many locations, you can give your buyers more peace of mind with less upfront cost. Choose the team that works with yours. Visit HomeTeam.com to learn more.
How do you measure that, though, right? Like, when people are tested and they face adversity, the true person comes out. But how do you stress test that on the front end before you get in a partnership type of situation with somebody or give them money?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately for them, they go through our vetting process. So, like, we don't bring anyone to a capital partner unless we would consider them a potential business partner, right? Which would, what does that mean? It means we're going to do things like, you know, frustratingly, Vern and I work tirelessly. We work a lot. But are they okay sitting on those deal calls at 9, 10, 11 at night? Are they coachable? So we're going to go through all of their numbers, all their docs with a fine tooth comb. And are they responsive to the hard things we say to them about kind of what's ugly, what doesn't work, what needs to be enhanced? Like, how do they take that constructive criticism? Are they coachable in the perspective of if the deal just doesn't work, are they willing to kind of let go? Or are they going to be strong-headed and kind of double down? And so what we find is that the process of being thorough with our due diligence process and having them be our partners in that due diligence process, it weeds a lot of people out because it's not easy, it's not fast, and it's not comfortable. And while it doesn't replicate what happens when tenants stop paying rent, or it doesn't replicate what happens when you need to do a major CapEx project or a capital call, It puts them in an uncomfortable space for an extended time that allows us to see how do they respond to stress, to being pushed, to being pulled, and to someone having someone question their judgment.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think there's a perfect formula for estimating and guesstimating whether someone's going to go rogue or behave. Like you said, people under stress can do anything. And so what I would say is that ultimately, if you do nothing else, try to play to your long-term best interest, not your short, just your short-term. Because invariably, If you sneak one across the goalpost, you may win in the short run. This is a very small community. People talk. And so inevitably, there's nothing that comes for free in this game. And so we've certainly been in situations where we worked with folks that down the road disappointed us. And you kind of, as you spend more time in this industry, just learn that, okay, I'm going to take that as a learning and try to adopt it when I speak to people going forward. But it's going to happen if you're in the industry long enough.
You mentioned something that was interesting to me. You said, make sure that you're, I'm paraphrasing, you're on track for the long-term vision. But I think in the world that we're in of instant gratification, everyone's looking right in front of their nose right now. So what are a couple of principles people can do to really think about the next 10 to 20? Because I think we underestimate what we can achieve there because we want to see success or feel the benefits of the decisions we make today.
You know, I'm going to say something that sounds silly given what you said, but you got to have to drown out the noise a little bit. If your version of preparing to be a real estate operator is sitting on Instagram or TikTok every day and watching somebody who's claiming to be a multimillionaire show you the ropes, you're probably going to get pulled into that rabbit hole where you're measuring yourself against some really unreasonable guidepost, and you're going to be persuaded to take big swings very quickly, and you may get lucky, or conversely, you're going to burn very fast. And that's why there's so much churn in our industry, right? Because everybody wants to get the quick win. Some people do. Everyone's fed by that desire to get there fast. If you drown out the noise a little bit and you look at the folks that have really been successful in this industry, it's traditionally not been the folks that are out taking the big swings unnecessarily and just getting there overnight. It's not an overnight business. In fact, if you want an overnight business, maybe we should be having a conversation about crypto or some other thing, you know, or have the AI conversation. But if you want to be in an industry where you can build generational wealth over a meaningful period of time, a reasonable period of time, it is very possible. And you don't have to be someone who came into wealth or came into only the top tier Ivy League, you know, track to get there. And I think that's the glimmer of hope that should kind of offset that drive to be super fast, right? The reason why we're patient is if you're disciplined, you can really do really well for yourself and your family and your family's family. But you got to apply discipline.
Are there any blueprints to that? Like when you guys think about building wealth, not just in a deal, but over a course of an investment life cycle, of a life, of a family, of generations, what do you think are the things that someone should be thinking about when it comes to real estate?
One of the things, and I'll let Eric share this, but I only say this because I view him as a really good paradigm of this. Many of the most successful people I know are some of the most unassuming and some of the ones that, at least on the surface, don't appear to be the biggest, loudest voice in the room. And so when we think about real estate and we think about the ability to build wealth, a lot of that cash flow isn't just coming all the time. It's lumpy. You may be in a deal that was the most brilliant deal, but for 3 or 4 years before you got to your big monetization, you weren't seeing any cash or very little cash coming out of it. So you have to be willing to take lumps in the short term. That may be to your own personal desires, to keep things afloat long enough to live to fight another day. Whether, I'll say, we talk to so many clients of ours, and frankly, we've been through this as entrepreneurs ourselves, where you have to really put off things you would love to do today in order to serve a longer term goal. And that, to your earlier point, is what kind of messed up in today's world, because if you're so obsessed with what's happening today and what I'm looking, I need to get the nice car, I need to have the big house, I need to go get the wardrobe, how will you ever be able to outrun your own expenses? So being a little bit miserly, not unnecessarily, but a little bit miserly in the short term can help give you enough runway to be able to survive to the big payday on the other side of the rainbow.
Spot on. The other thing I'll add is I say constantly seek alpha. So, you know, on Wall Street, we use alpha to underpin kind of fund managers who get outperformed returns, right? And so how do you do that in the real estate world? So alpha means value. Kind of, are there additional ways to increase value? So, you know, in one of our classes, we teach folks about how to unearth opportunities. Two people walk down a neighborhood. One person walks down a neighborhood and they say, oh, this house, this neighborhood is lots of homes, single family and duplexes. The next person walks down that exact same neighborhood. And because their knowledge has expanded, they see, oh, amongst these homes, there are infill lots. Behind these homes, there are alleyways, and this neighborhood allows for ADUs. And so now there's opportunity, accelerated dwelling units, and so now there's opportunities to build additional units. At the corners of those lots, there are quadplexes and small multifamily complexes, which means the infill lots have an opportunity to apply for variances. Mm-hmm. Their knowledge has expanded to the point where they can see the opportunities to expand and pursue alpha, whereas the first person sees single families and duplexes. And so whatever your strategy is, we say optimize your knowledge set so that you can optimize your ability to seek alpha. And we do this on a project level, but we also do this on a business level. We get a lot of calls for folks saying, hey, you know, do you need help growing your sales funnel? Well, not really. Why? Because every single person that comes into our funnel, we're probably going to do business with them somewhere between 5 and 10 times. At least 5 up to 10, because we view every client relationship as an opportunity to generate alpha through that relationship. So are there 5 concentric touch points where we can improve the way you grow your business, improve your access to capital, improve your ability to execute on a deal? And by virtue of that, our repeat business metrics out kind of are through the roof. And so that is our funnel. Our future funnel represents our captive funnel and all the referrals we're going to get. And if you take that approach with real estate deals and your entrepreneurship or your corporate careers, seek alpha and ways to generate value, we find it's a recipe for winning.
If I took us back up just a little more macro for a second, because one of the conversations we've had a lot here on the Color Money podcast is trying to identify what some of the major barriers and gaps are so that we can design solutions. We got to have a theory of the problems. We can have a theory of the solution. You guys have probably seen more than anybody else. I think you said earlier, something just seemed that people didn't get that last credit approval. They didn't make it to the finish line. Do you guys, in all your experience, are there things that you could say are themes that we should be working on as a broader community of people of color in real estate? That what are those gaps as you see them? And what are some of the solutions that you're seeing on ways that they can be closed? And how can we as a community stand up more businesses, more relationships or partnerships that start to close those gaps?
You're going to get us kicked off the air because we're getting into the good stuff, into the soapbox stuff. So there's a lot of ways to approach that. The first thing I would say is one of the biggest, and we know this, right? Historically, communities of color are not sitting on as much wealth as other communities, right? That has a very direct impact on our ability to seed fund our own businesses. And so you can teach someone how to get a loan, but if the loan's only going to be 70 cents on every dollar, they still need 30 cents, right? So we as a community have to be more thoughtful, more deliberate about how do we help our businesses fund that 30. Because that 30 plus the funds that it costs to operate these startups is what's going to be the catalytic dollars to help us build the next, you know, black and brown Airbnb. And so that's beyond a real estate issue in my mind. That is just a structural issue that we've been working to address. One of the ways Eric and I do that is we try to educate various segments of the market that there's an opportunity. We had a meeting with a collective of black and brown owners of Chick-fil-A franchises. Well, we said, if there's 12 of you, there is a massive multiplier effect. If all of you put a pot of capital together so that we could support our developers, right? Now, there's some real heft behind the idea that there's equity to turbocharge. And so we need to find as a community those pockets of wealth because they exist. Mm-hmm. There's the pockets of wealth in the franchise owners. There's pockets of wealth among corporate professionals that have been in their role for 20, 30 years. There's pockets, obviously, in entertainment and in sports. That has been a very hard area for us to penetrate. We create a lot of wealth there, but how it gets distributed a lot of times through handlers, waste, mismanagement, somehow it's not trickling back to our own businesses. We need to penetrate that. When we do that, we become a lot less dependent on third parties that, frankly, may just not want to prioritize us. It's not their obligation to do so. It'd be nice if they did, but we need to be in a position where even if they don't, we can leverage our own wealth in ways that can help at least get us farther up the scale to recycle that money. So I'll leave it there and let Eric jump in, but I think we have to be screaming from the mountaintop that there is wealth within our community that is not being deployed. And there are developers that are pursuing projects that can dramatically change the composition of life in certain urban inner cities. We need to connect that better. And we need to have frank conversations with, I would say, the broad community of high net worth, wealthy and rich Black Americans, and how we actually take some of that capital and mobilize it. It's great to put it in a money manager's hands and say, grow it for me. I guarantee you they are not distributing that money back to our own entrepreneurs.
What I'll also say is that our community needs to ensure that we are ready to receive the monies when they become available. What does that mean? So our institutional advisory practice, we work with family offices, foundations, CDFIs to create products specifically to address this equity gap amongst the emerging developer space. But even with the availability of those products, it doesn't change that their credit standards will still seek sponsors who have a prepared personal financial statement. A lot of us don't. Who have decent credit. A lot of us don't. Who have a sponsor bio. A lot of us don't. Who have a team. Doesn't mean that they're employees, but who can speak to what is the roster of attorney, accountant, contractor, property manager, et cetera, relationship resource that you have in place that is ready to help you with executing on your business plan. Those things don't require money. They require diligence and intention with making sure that you've addressed them. They require you being astute enough to make sure that they're ready at all times, but that's outside of the money. But to Vernon's point, we do believe it's going to happen. But when our communities, when our capital-rich members of our communities make their capital available, they'll still require that sponsors pass a certain baseline. And so each sponsor should consider it their homework to be ready when the capital becomes available.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the readiness is also understanding the resources that are actually currently available, right? So if you're doing deals and your plans are to scale your real estate business and you don't know that there are companies like the diversified companies that will fund your earnest money deposit, there are companies like diversified companies that will introduce you to someone, the friendly millionaire or billionaire that can act as your guarantor. If you don't know that, you also haven't done your homework. And so there's the personal preparation, but there's also kind of building your domain expertise so you understand the resources readily available to you. And then those two things represent the preparation that will better align you for meeting the capital.
I'll just add very quickly to that. So I'll give you a story just to throw a little like cold water on the listener's face, right? Like to give you a sense of where we really sit in this dynamic. We were having a conversation with a impact investment organization, and they were trying to figure out how to deploy capital to emerging developers. And a member of their board said, "Why are we even thinking about this, guys? Like, this is like, you know, we're going to have to throw out concessionary capital, meaning like really cheap money, and we probably won't get any of it back because these are like, they're like emerging developers. They don't know what they're doing, right? Like, why are we even focusing on this?" So like taking a step back, that's the mindset that a lot of investors have about our developers, right? Don't know what they're doing or pursuing like really hard deals, you know, without the requisite experience. We're basically going to have to treat this as free money to wrap our heads around why we should give it. We have to do, and we do, but we have to continue to be mindful that that's the perception. So we have to pursue deals that make sense. We got to post wins on the scoreboard, and we got to be able to throw that right back in their face and say, "No, that's not true. Look, I did a great job on this project. Look at my returns." And so to Eric's point, but you can't do that if you don't even really know what you're solving for. So we have to start, again, that frustration of starting like here and climbing here, not just jumping here. You got to be able to answer all those questions in your mind so I know, okay, this is what I'm trying to get to. I need to hit this 20% return on this deal. So anytime someone even tries to suggest that the reason why they're not going to invest me on the next deal is because I'm just some guy and I'm just a handout, I can show them a deal. I don't get mad. I don't get crazy about it. I'll show them the deal and let the numbers prove themselves. That is just patently wrong.
Does it make sense for investors that flip houses to have a portfolio book of what they've done in order to get financed then?
And it's not just the fix and flippers. Whatever spectrum you're in, you should be keeping a portfolio book into. And why is it benefit? I'll tell you a story of a client. We have a client we've done some coaching with. He didn't have a book, but he had real prints. Just simply by taking his wins, these fix and flip deals, and he had done maybe 200 flips, taking these flips, putting the narrative behind it, showing his business thesis, showing his market focus, showing his team in place, showing the narrative, and putting it in that institutional package is what he's been able to go out and use with raising capital. And so, granted, now he's not doing flips, he's doing multifamily housing, but he's using the foundational marketing collateral that he's using to shop the capital markets. It's from him documenting his flips, photos, acquisition prices, your return on investment, treating it as though he had third-party capital from the beginning, documenting all of it and storybooking it.
It's really interesting. You guys have shared so much today in finding these spaces where our knowledge and our capital needs come together, and how one thinks about credibility and relationships and thinking about the long-term game. And then also the power of being able to present what you've done and who you are to others, so that they have an opportunity to sort of see both the uniqueness and the collective strength. And I think this balance between uniqueness and collective strength, which is often used against our community, it's often the success is seen as a uniqueness. So when you're a successful, it's just Vern, he did all by himself, or Eric did all by himself. They forget it was the community that they created, that relationship that built it. So then it becomes individual. But when it's emerging developers, it's collective and the whole room is the same. So I think learning how to flip that on its head and know when to be unique and when to be collective for us on the flip side of that becomes very powerful. We are pretty much at time. It's been an awesome conversation. Any closing thoughts you guys have for us, or Daniel, any closing things? But Vernon, Eric, anything you guys have to close out our listeners you think they should be thinking about as they look to this space of real estate as a way to build generational wealth for their families, and think about how they should relate to capital?
I'll let Eric close. But what I would say is that we're obviously living in a very volatile world, right? Where there's probably never been more fear and trepidation as to entrepreneur or professional of color, whether there will be resources and support for whatever we're pursuing. I'll say patently that the answer is yes. That there are organizations like yours, Bo, organizations like ours and Diversified that are meant to help answer these questions. These are hard questions that you're asking. And so there are resources and will continue to be resources for our community. And folks should not feel pressure to be the individual who's trying to claw at it themselves. This is a collective process. And so the job, really, more so than understanding every aspect of the deal, is understanding what people you can leverage to help put something together. And we're happy to be a part of that process for the ecosystem and for your listeners.
Yeah. Last thing I think I would say is that, you know, people see successful folks and they say, oh, you're so lucky. Well, you know, luck is when opportunity meets preparation. And so I would say, get prepared. And as part of your preparation process, be vigilant about constantly seeking alpha in your projects, your work, your platforms. Dive fully commit to seeking out opportunities to optimize and differentiate your returns.
Great conversation, guys. Thank you for joining us. So there you have it from Vernon and Eric, the ultimate facilitators of connecting value, capital, knowledge together in our community. So make sure you check them out at Diversified Lending Solutions, and hopefully we can have them back on the podcast sometime in the future. Thanks a lot, guys.
Follow the Color of Money podcast today and get notified when new episodes are released weekly.
Be part of this transformative listening experience.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. The views, thoughts, and opinions of the guest represent those of the guest and not Keller Williams Realty LLC and its affiliates, and should not be construed as financial, economic, legal, tax, or other advice. This podcast is provided without any warranty or guarantee of its accuracy, completeness, timeliness, or results from using the information.